it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
In episode 138 of Circles Off, we're joined by the winner of the Circa Millions Pro Football Contest, Matty Saint, breaking down how he got into the contest, his strategy throughout, if anything changed as he went along, and a whole lot more. This week's Circles Off starts now.
Come on, let's go!
Welcome to Circles Off, episode number 138, right here, part of the Hammer Betting Network, and presented by Pinnacle Sportsbook. I'm Rob Pizzola, joined by Johnny from BetStamp.
Robbie P, what's going on?
I don't think I've seen you that sweater before with the purple lettering.
This gray is the the gray and purple.
It's a banger.
Your limited edition.
Also, this one's a banger, right?
That is a banger. A lot of people received some Pinnacle swag in Ontario the other day. No thanks to the podcast. We've been getting a lot of hate mail. People want us to do some merch giveaways. Rob, where are we on that?
We got one going on right now. You can head over to thehammer.bet/thenails. And you can sign up for merch giveaway, Pinnacle swag bag, BetStamp swag bag as well. Free to enter. It's all you got to do. Head over to thehammer.bet/thenails. We do have some message boards there as well if you just want to join part of the community. But we're going to be doing a Q&A coming up here probably in a few weeks. Post-Super Bowl, we're going to take a bunch of questions in there. So in the Circles Off thread as well, post any questions you want to see us answer on the Q&A, and we will get to those as well.
Episode 138 is number 38. So this one was one I saw a guy in Vegas at a UFC event wearing this jersey, and I was fired up. Carlos Zambrano.
Oh, Zambrano, yeah. Zambrano, man, if that guy could have figured out his control, he would have been, I mean, he was a great pitcher for a while, but he was all over the place.
I think Kurt Schilling's was the better pitcher.
Fake blood in the sock. I'm still not buying that story.
That was, yeah, you've talked about it before. You're not buying that.
Who else is 38? Conspiracy theory on the Schilling.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah, that went viral, that one, I think. Yeah. You know, knowing what I know about Kurt Schilling after the fact, like in real time, I thought it was blood. But now my opinion of him has changed over time.
Ketchup packet.
It could have been something. I wouldn't put it past him. If there was like an athlete, I wouldn't put it past to do something like that. It's Kurt Schilling.
NFL, we have Ramondre Stevenson running back on the Patriots right now.
Yeah.
He'll be out of the league in a couple of years.
38s are tough. They're really tough.
Any NHLs?
Like
Rasmus Sandin.
Fraser McLaren, former Maple
former
Leaf.
Leaf. Yeah,
former
we know
tough
all the
guy.
Leafs.
It's tough. Pavel Dimitra used to wear, Pavel Dimitra, rest in peace, used to wear 38. He was a great player for a while. I think he died in a plane crash.
Yeah, he did.
It was a plane crash.
Oh, right? His team.
Yeah. His team. Yeah. That was messed up.
Very sad.
It's messed up. You don't see stuff like that very often. Also, what you don't see very often is what happened over at ESPN Bet this week. What the fuck was that?
The score bet over in Canada for those listening.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, apparently something blew up where you can get an off-market price on the Ravens. What do you think happened there?
I honestly have been thinking about this for a while. So it was basically like 1.5 games where this happened for, right? It was the Ravens for a bit and the Chiefs as well. I don't have a great explanation.
So explain to people what the edge was there.
So basically, one specific sports book dealing way off market prices. Like when I say way off market, you could have arbed basically anywhere else on the other side on these games. That's how off market it was. And like, you just don't see that. That doesn't happen in our industry. Nowadays, Pinnacle, you know, market making books out there, set a line, they move, everybody else goes and copies them. It's very unusual. You're gonna see a major market NFL side up at a very different price. And I'm going to go back. We can erase that on the board, Zach, because I consulted for sportsbooks back in the day. And I'm going to tell you, when I consulted for a major offshore sportsbook, if they were going to do something like this and put out way off market prices to generate like more, first time depositors or just get like a bunch of traction to the sportsbook, they would have promoted the shit out of it. Like they would have spent an entire week promoting that they had that offer available.
They didn't promote it at all.
No, yeah. This wasn't there. Then you got to ask yourself, like, was it just a mistake where they didn't cap the boost? Like, bet boosts everywhere are limited, right? You go place a bet a boost somewhere, it's $50, $100 here and there. Maybe they didn't, you know, just they didn't cap it. Someone forgot to do that. But that doesn't explain how, like, my buddy Hitman could get a $15,000 bet, whereas I could get a $750 bet, and my other buddy, who's already limited on his account, could only get a $50 bet. Like, something's not adding up here.
I think they just messed up, not a promo.
I honestly don't know if it was related to the Mattress Mac thing, but I think that they had real big exposure on sides where they had to do something to balance the act. That this is my rational explanation for this. I don't know what else it could be. It'd be actually very interesting if at some point we could talk to Shipper again and get him back on the show just to do, like, walk through this specific example. But
the fact that they had no promo, in my opinion, pretty much rules out the fact that it was on purpose, like, as a promotion, because they didn't advertise it. Like, I don't think it was a promo to get people to sign up and, right, like, do it, whether they got people to sign up or not. The other thing is, if you're going to, like, lay off action, or sorry, not lay off action, I don't know what do you want to even call it, but if you're going to try to, like, reduce liability for the sports book, like, I don't think you have to go that off market on the number. You could have just been a little, you could have just been so they were dealing -9.5 plus 110, and you could play back on any other sports book roughly at plus 10 minus 110. So you would have had, like, a zero risk chance at what would be like a half middle there. If Houston lost by exactly 10, you would have won the ESPN bet and lost wherever else you played it. But if you can bet unlimited on that, it seems like a no-brainer for the average bettor looking to cash in on a potential lottery ticket with no risk.
I think, like, I've gone through all the scenarios in my head. None of them really make a lot of sense. The only one that somewhat makes sense is that they just had a ton of exposure on the game. How they built up that exposure, I don't know. Typically speaking, in my experience, in order to get to an exposure that high, the trading team would have to go to the CEO or to the board of directors and say, hey, like, we're building up this, you know, potential loss here. Are you guys comfortable with that? And then the board or the CEO or executive team would make a decision and tell people what to do in that instance. I don't know. I honestly don't know how you get to that.
Well, what did they take on the plus 10? Or did they take plus 10, plus 9.5? Like, what were they high on exposure? Because they could have opened themselves up to even more exposure, essentially, on a...
Yeah, I agree.
On a push.
It's almost like someone was making a decision at another level that was like, no, we can't lose X amount of dollars. If this happens, do whatever you can to get off as much of this position as possible. We're comfortable with this amount of exposure. And then they run that. But why they would, like, give X amount of bets to some people and Y amount of bets to others. And I honestly don't. One day I'd love to see a 30 for 30 on what exactly happened here, because a lot of it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And it's, you know, it's a new sports book in the United States. Really weird overall. But you know what? I'm all about treating players very fairly. I don't like when sports books give X limits to one guy, Y to another, Z to another. And that's why I highly recommend you check out Pinnacle Sportsbook, the fairest book for sports bettors out there. Limits are always posted on every single bet. Can just click it. What I get to bet is the same as what Johnny gets to bet. It's the same as what Zach gets to bet. And you get to do it at very good prices as well. They pride themselves on the low margins. We talk about it all the time on this show, but you better be price shopping. And you got to do that with Pinnacle, in business for 25 years for a reason. So bet smart, bet Pinnacle, your trusted sportsbook the past 25 years. Use code HAMMER when signing up, as it does help support the show here, Circles Off. Of course, you must be 19 plus, not available in the US. And as always, please play responsibly. We do have a guest episode today, but before we get into it, we are very close to cracking 5K subs here on Circles Off. Do what you can, sub down below, hit that notification bell so you get alerted when we have new episodes. And of course, if you can as well, share this out to the community. People are giving us great feedback on the recent shows. We love putting them together, but we do want to get this out to the masses. So please share our content as well. Our guest this week, comes to us as the winner of this year's Circa Million, taking home $1 million top prize with a record of 62-27-1 against the spread. An all-time great season. You can follow him on Twitter at Matty Saint. Matt Saint now joins us here on Circles Off. Matt, how's it going?
It's going great, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem at all.
Matt, congrats on the big win. Very impressive, obviously, and you know, a lot of game theory and strategy in this contest. Before we get into that, why don't you just tell us about yourself? You know, how did you kind of get into betting, the contest, stuff like that, and a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I work in finance, revenue and markets, a big, large Fortune 500 company. Reside in the suburbs of Minneapolis with my wife. I've got twin, 5-year-old boy, girl. So that's just, you know, a little bit of my personal background from a sports betting background, contest background. We don't have legalized gambling in Minnesota, so it's a little challenging. So my gambling background revolves around boys' trips to Vegas, and then office pools and pick'em contests with me and my buddies at home. So not too much from a background standpoint as far as like the big Vegas contests, like the Super Contest or the Circa Millions. This was a first go around at it.
So you mentioned the contest. A lot of us have done those office pools, really fun. Do you do any like flat betting or straight betting yourself?
Not too much, just a dabbling a little bit. Yeah, so a lot of my background is pretty limited, to be honest. It's just, you know, I've got a couple buddies that we text back and forth, or we create lines in our heads the last few years. So the background on this is, you know, pretty rare probably, but yeah, I don't have much of a betting career or historical, you know, presence or anything like that. This is kind of a first time go at it and definitely struck lightning here.
Yeah. So that's interesting because, you know, let's start right at the beginning of this story right here with the Circa Millions for this year. But most people who aren't involved in regulated sports betting or betting on a day-to-day basis, they might not even know that a contest like Circa Millions exists out there. Obviously, it's very big for us who are in the betting space, people who frequent Circa and travel there, you know, to Las Vegas. How did you find out about the competition in the first place?
Yeah, so I've been following Derek and Mike Palm for years through VSiN. They were back on My Guys in the Desert. So I'd listen to VSiN almost every day, you know, even without sports betting legalized. I just found, you know, a lot of interest in the markets and the numbers and stuff and, you know, working with numbers every day. I just found that to be a lot more fun and relevant to follow around like the NFL and stuff. And then obviously I play a lot of DFS, so you know, a lot of the Vegas lines contribute into DFS methodology and game theory also, so you'd be paying attention in that regard. But as far as Circa Millions, you know, been a big fan of Derek and Mike Palm from the sidelines for a number of years. I had done some offshore contests with a book and to kind of test the waters, and I knew Circa Millions was there, so I wanted to, you know, at least test my skills a little bit the last couple of years before entering the Circa Million, just because, you know, I'd play low stakes, like $50, $100 entries for a full year, you know, $1,000 entries, a kind of a different, different stakes for what I'm used to. So that's how I got interested in it. I've been following it for a number of years. And then last year it was right around the Super Bowl where I had a conversation with my wife, like, I want to do this contest. I want to bet on myself. I want to do millions. I want to sign up for Survivor. And then started the kind of the planning process at that time.
Did you end up going with one entry? Or did you do multi entries for this year?
I just did the one entry for millions. I had two Survivor, one millions. Yeah, just wanted to test it out. This was my first year entering, so I didn't want to go too big.
Well, you did go big, absolutely. So what was your strategy picking? Were you just like trying to originate the plays, or was it more like looking at the numbers and seeing what was contest strategy?
Yeah, it was very holistic. I had a pretty in-depth process that I kind of started off right away. I had done my own power ratings last winter, and then I updated that throughout the draft and free agency process. And then I kind of compared my ratings versus the opening lines for week one just to see how close I was. So that was kind of like step one in the process. And then once you had 3 or 4 weeks of data throughout the season, I'd bring in more of the advanced metrics with DVOA and EPA as those meant more as the season went on. And then I'd also, you know, do a lot of individual matchup analysis. So comparing the offensive line versus defensive lines, I'd compare the wide receiver versus cornerback matchups and try to gain a little bit of understanding of, you know, coverage schemes or the different personnel tendencies and, you know, where teams were good versus bad. So it was a very holistic process. I would do a full matchup analysis for each game. And then I'd also kind of come up with my own score in my head, compare it against power ratings, you know, and then create a short card and then ultimately a confidence factor that I had just in like gut, you know, feel of, you know, based on eye tests, based on my numbers, you know, how did everything sort through and kind of sort it out. And then obviously as the week would progress on Fridays and Saturdays, you could see how the lines and the markets would move versus what the contest lines, you know, those are stagnant as of Thursday afternoons, you know, see how those, you know, change over the remaining 48 hours before picks were due.
So did you put your picks in right before they were due or a bit earlier?
Typically it was, you know, within an hour or two of pick submission. I think the first couple weeks I'd submit Friday nights, and I, you know, I kind of learned early on I need to prolong that as long as possible. So I coach my kids hockey on Saturday mornings, so sometimes that'd be a conflict where like I would just try to get that in so I wouldn't, you know, miss my picks or get caught up in the locker room or anything like that. So but I ultimately, you know, as the week or as the year progressed, my process got a lot more refined, and I could, you know, Friday nights were long nights in my office just going through everything, and I'd usually go to bed with probably my five picks at that point with two alternates. And then I'd compare on Saturdays when I'd get home and just make sure that I still felt comfortable with what I had wrote down.
Yeah. So you had a pretty thorough process in coming up with your number for the game. Was all of that manual? And if so, like how long was it taking you on a weekly basis? Because that's pretty time consuming comparing O-lines, D-lines of every team, all the matchup based analysis. If you're just doing it, basically by hand or manually, how much was actually going into this on a weekly basis?
Yeah, it became a full-time job, if not more than my regular day job, if I'm not gonna lie to you about it. But I did use a lot of sources though. Like I'd use the Ben Baldwin has great resources. So his EPA metrics I'd download, the Sumer Sports databases were great to leverage. So I'd use those. There's multiple sites where you can download data, and then I'd manually feed it into my Excel spreadsheets, and then I'd have full matchup comparisons, and you know, I'd 20 or 25 different comparisons, which probably became over analysis at the end of the day of things. But I guess just kind of falls back in, you know, what I do for work and everything. Like I'm kind of a, you know, an analytical guy by nature. So that just kind of falls into my skill set and how I like to think things through at the end of the day.
How much were you influenced by outside sources, if at all? So a lot of times whenever people are handicapping the NFL, they might be consuming like five different pieces of content over the course of the week from people that they respect. And maybe that might alter their opinion based off of something that somebody says, whether it's explicitly a pick that's given out or maybe just an angle in the game. How much of that fed into what you did? Did you consume content on a weekly basis? Or was this just like, you know, I'm going to clear my head, do my own thing, submit my own numbers?
No, I definitely consumed a lot of content, maybe too much content at the end of the day. Just a couple off the top of my head, I'd listen to Chernoff almost every day. I'd listen to your show with Suma and with Hitman on Wednesdays as an example. And so what I would do during those podcasts, I take a lot of notes. There's a lot of work and stuff that I don't have the capacity to do, and because, you know, this is my full-time job. So I try to understand angles that I might not have considered. I'd also try to like hear a devil's advocate. So if I have a lean on a game and someone, you know, has a different lean, try to like understand why. And then also it helped me understand where I think the public versus the sharp, you know, side of games could ultimately be, and also understand what consensus picks could be at the end of the day too. So I would take a lot of notes, try to understand where the sides were. I tried not to let it influence what I ultimately picked. You know, sometimes there'd be, you know, if I was confident in three or four games and I was struggling for a fifth, you know, maybe rely on some of the notes I took through the week and maybe some of the people I really respected of what their heavy leans were or best bets. But I tried not to influence that just because I didn't want to be, you know, just going with, you know, the groupthink process of everything. So yeah, definitely consumed a lot of content, but I was also just trying to sort through it all and try to understand where the picks were going to be landing from a consensus standpoint as well.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I appreciate your support in listening to Rob's show. I don't know how much that contributed to the overall win.
My best bets this year, listen, very small sample size, but whenever you're over 500 and you make money, you got to pat yourself on the back and promote it as much as possible.
Stay away from Hitman this year, I guess, was the takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, if you just faded his best bets for one of your picks every single week, you would have went like 15-3.
If you tailed him, you would have ended up at the bottom too, so you actually would have still made money.
Booby prize, yeah.
Go for the booby prize next year with him.
So as the contest progressed, I'm assuming at the start there's not much stress in there, right? It's a $1,000 entry, but as it starts getting into the money and you realize like, hey, I'm near the top of the board, maybe let's say, actually I guess, how many weeks left until you started like really sweating and you're like, wow, I might win this thing?
I would say the probably the week after Thanksgiving. So I had jumped from like 30th in the contest to 9th, and then the following week I had like a 4-1 or 5-0 again and went to first for the first time. That's when like the anxiety really like started to like hit, and it was like more of like, I don't want to screw this up, I don't want to miss, you know, something that's really apparent. So I would go probably to the next level of going through the games, and at times like I think I overdid it, but I also just didn't want this opportunity to go and like kick myself at the end of the day for not spending that extra hour or two in the office of trying to like look for every nook and cranny through a matchup, and trying to find any sort of edge or thought that I had. So that was when the anxiety really started kicking in. And then I would also say that was the first week I had the thought of like, I truly do have a shot at winning the contest. I had surpassed a lot of players. You know, Fezzik, for instance, he was in the top five for almost the whole season up until the last 3 weeks. You know, seeing him at the top of the board and knowing his track record in these contests, like I knew it wasn't going to be easy going down the stretch. And I, you know, I was fearful every Saturday of submitting a 1-4 or 0-5. That was like going through the back of my mind every week of just like, hopefully this isn't the week where, you know, the regression hits.
Wow. Yeah. I can imagine the pressure that's in that type of situation. I mean, in the beginning of the year, it's everyone's game, whatever. You submit your picks, you hope for the best. But once you're actually at the top and you can, you know, realize, you can almost taste the money. It's I'm sure it's a different story. On the same subject, I kind of want to just like talk about the evolution of the contest as the year goes on, because you're there at the beginning of the year, you're making your picks, you're going through your process, but I'm sure there's probably not a lot of game theory that's going through your head at the beginning of the year. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine you're running your numbers, you're playing your biggest edges. You get to Thanksgiving, you know, you get that bump, you now see yourself in the top 10. Down the stretch, I imagine that things were very different for you in making selections, because you have to be more cognizant of what other people are thinking.
Oh, 100%. There was a, you know, week 17 is a great example of that. It was Jags and Panthers. And the contest line was 6. I think it got down to 3 or 3.5. And I had a 1.5 or 2 point lead at that point. So that became like almost an auto play, just based like, you know, there's huge closing line value. You know, I'm guessing that, you know, out of the top 10 or top 15, like, you know, 50% plus are going to be on that game as well. So even if I really wasn't a big fan of it per se, like, I think it just becomes a play. You know, earlier on in the year, I think like I benefited from fading some of those closing line value games. It was definitely not an auto play for me at that point. You know, one of the games that comes to mind is like the San Francisco Cleveland game earlier in the year. I think the contest closed at 6. I think the line was at like 10 or something by the time kickoff came. And I was just like, man, Cleveland's got a great D. The weather's going to be crummy. You know, there's going to be a lot of people on this game. So I ultimately just faded it. So I benefited from, you know, examples like that. But then at the end of the year, the game theory standpoint, even, you know, week 18, I took Baltimore with I think the contest line was four. They got down to +3 at kickoff. Yeah. And then the Giants as well, the contest line was +5. They was +4. So there's two examples there where I ended up taking the closing line value as like chip leader, where I was actually a fan of the Giants. The Baltimore game was fine too. But I also envisioned that out of the top 10, like there was going to be a lot of overlap. And so during that time frame with like game theory, et cetera, like I wasn't opposed to overlaps there and kind of having blockers and, you know, crossing people, you know, in fifth to 10th place out of the money.
Were you manically refreshing the Circa Twitter account to see when the picks would come out? Or were you just like, you know, I got my picks in, I'll see what's going on.
Did you go through every person and then see that?
Not until the last probably 2 or 3 weeks did I start going through that. Like I had always watched the VSiN on Saturday nights. There'd be the contest show. So I'd watch that just to see where the top five was, where it was landing. And then week 18, I was actually in Vegas. I did a VSiN segment right when the picks were being announced. So I like scrambled. I did the VSiN segment, went up to the hotel room. I got my computer open and was, you know, kind of scrambling to figure out where everybody was and figure out what kind of hedge plays I needed to lay in the book on Saturday night, Sunday morning. So I had a group of three buddies out there with me sweating the games. We had fun just trying to, you know, dial everything in on Saturday night and Sunday morning. So that was great. But yeah, for the last like 2 or 3 weeks, top 10, I'd kind of document what their picks were and sort through it. And then as I made my picks week 18, that was probably the most I tried to like understand where the top five had been playing for the last like 3 or 4 weeks, try to understand if they had any trends or things I could pick up on, if they were guys that played closing line value or if they were dog players or they like to play faves or, you know, home team, road team stuff. So I really dug in that week probably more than any other week, just because prior to that, there's so much variance and volatility with making five picks with how many people are in contention. I thought it was kind of a fruitless exercise, to be honest. But week 17, week 18, it became a lot more real and exercisable, I'd say.
Yeah, so week 18, you're at Circa, you're watching the games. I was going to ask you about hedging because we talked about the Survivor pool, which was massive for this competition. It was like 9 million and whether or not people were going to be hedging, working out deals. You're in first place going into the final week of the season, and you did decide to hedge on some of your plays there.
I did on week 18. I didn't do anything, you know, prior to that, just because, like I said, there's so much variability and volatility with five picks against the spread, with how tight the standings are every week. And, you know, you have one bad week and you're kind of, you know, you can fall from a 1 million to 30,000 really quick. But week 18, I had a really good understanding of kind of where my fall points were. So I was able to place like a pretty reasonable bet. I had Falcons +3.5 week 18. So I was able to take the opposite with Saints and monetize that. And then, so that was one of the bigger plays of the week. And then going into the final game was the Miami and Buffalo game. And I knew I just needed Buffalo just to even push would have got me the championship there. So I did do a fairly sizable hedge on the Dolphins that night. But still definitely top heavy. But it was able to at least, you know, bridge the gap a little bit if Buffalo fell that night.
What was the feeling watching that Bills game? Because I don't remember it exactly, but it, like, what a sweat that it comes down to the final game of the year, Sunday Night Football for you. I'm pretty sure the Dolphins had the lead in the first half of that game, and then Buffalo just had an incredible second half. What's going through your head during that game?
My going through my head is, man, the Bills probably left 17 points on the field in the first half. And then the second thought was, man, second place will be just as good. So I wasn't really too nervous throughout that whole game until Deontay Hardy had that 95-yard punt return, and that got me and my buddies like fired up again, because we had kind of just been like mellow, like just absorbing everything going on that night. And then Buffalo took, I think they got the punt return to tie it up. I think they went 3 and out, and then they marched down and got like a lead with like 7 minutes to go. And that's like when the nerves really started to like hit me that I could win, because up until that point, you're kind of just like, all right, I got second locked in at worst. But then you can like, it's in your hands at that point, and you want it so bad that like, you're just, you're firing, like, every sort of part of emotion in your body is going crazy. And then Josh Allen had a fourth and inches that, you know, if he converts that, they just take, you know, two or three knees and it's over. And he didn't get it. And so me and my buddies were standing up. We were standing up ready for that. He didn't get it. I'm like, all right, guys, let's go sit down. And so we're like,
they still got it on the, I think it was a pick there at the end.
Right? Yeah. So what's going through my head at that point was, man, all right, Dolphins are going to march down. Tua's going to hit Tyreek on a long play. They're going to go for two because they're banged up.
They
don't want to play overtime, you know, and no matter what happens, that circumstance, you know, Ryan, who was in second place, he's going to cover the game and take first place. So that was going through my brain. And then, you know, the minute that, I can't remember, was it Rapp that made that interception?
Yeah.
My wife FaceTimes me immediately. And we, you know, we have a really, really awesome moment together. Like she's stunned and shocked. I'm stunned and shocked. Like, how is this even real? Like, this is real life right now. So it was just such a cool moment to experience that, even though it was FaceTime with my wife. And I had my, you know, three of my best buds out there too. And so we had a heck of a night, I'd say.
Oh yeah, that's a truly amazing moment just to celebrate that with your friends and family. In the sports book at that time, was there like a buzz around you? Did people know who you were? Like, you were the guy that was going to win millions in real time, or was it just your tight-knit group of friends there?
It was basically just the tight-knit group. We had a group to our right that was kind of making comments like, "Oh, I remember my first $1,000 play too." They had no idea. You know, it's like we'd be celebrating and, you know, they're kind of giving us, you know, crap,
like,
or whatever.
$1 million on the line here, bud. Yeah.
And they have no clue. Two tables to our left were the guys that ended up finishing third or fourth, and they had Buffalo too. So we hadn't known each other until probably halftime, and we kind of like figured it out. The second place guy, I hadn't seen him all day. And, you know, when I talked to him last weekend at the award ceremony, he had been hanging out kind of incognito at the, you know, the upper level of Circa. Just kind of mellow, I guess, you know, Saturday night, everything was going his way, and that's where him and his buddies were hanging out. So they didn't want to lose the karma there. So there was no like buzz around me at all. Derek had him and like the survivor winners hanging up in his little area where he likes to sit. So there wasn't really too much commotion or anything, but there's definitely a Buffalo Bills side in the book, I'd say. Like, it seemed like anytime Buffalo did anything good, there was a little bit more of a roar versus when the Dolphins were. So I think there were a lot of Buffalo Bills supporters in that room that night.
Yeah, very interesting story. Just a really random question here, just out of curiosity. When you were hedging your bets that day, did Circa let you do it on credit? Like, were you able to take it out of your winnings even though, you know, you hadn't won yet, or do you actually have to bring a boatload of cash with you to get it done?
A duffel bag. Yeah.
I would say like the Circa staff was incredible during this whole process. Jeff Benson was awesome to work with. They loaned on credit, and they adjusted, you know, whatever you needed based off of, you know, where you were in the contest. I know that Survivor's probably a little easier to understand the monetization, but, you know, Jeff Benson, his team, Derek, and the whole team, they were really open with markers and credit that weekend. So I was able to, you know, take out without flying across country with a duffel bag of cash. The volumes I was able to hedge at, that'd be a little tough to get out of my own bank account, I'd say that too.
For sure. Well, congrats on the win once again. Very cool story. I could only imagine how much fun that must have been, like being in the book. And then like it ended, you know, on a game winning interception to end the game. So it wasn't even over. Like sometimes, I mean, I guess you probably would have been just as fired up maybe to, you know, for the Bills to have been up by 30 and had it sealed by the start of the fourth. But to have like the one play that does it, that's even more of a fire up. And yeah. I remember actually I had the Bills that game as well. And I was fired up for the obviously nowhere near the bet size there, but a lot of fun. I was riding with you that day. Nice. Here's what I was going to ask you in general. All right. You win a million. Probably a lot of people are asking you this. What are you going to do with that? Are you going to roll that into some sort of like, you know, betting bankroll now and like start to doing this more, or is it savings?
Oh, it's savings and investment. You're talking to a finance guy here. So I'll be, you know, Uncle Sam's going to take a good chunk of change in taxes. So you have to put a good amount to the side of that. And then Load up our kids' 529 education funds, and then invest the difference probably for a while. You know, my wife and I, we've had the talks in the last couple of years of getting like a lake place in Minnesota. So we'll have a cabin with a boat down in the future here. But for now, we'll invest and let it grow a little bit. You know, put some aside for the taxes, make sure the kids are taken care of, and that's the only thing. You know, that's on our radar right now. So try to be prudent and responsible with it.
So it's not, I guess you'd call it then, not necessarily life-changing money. Like nothing's really going to change, you know, a couple investments.
It's life-changing though. Like we're not going to change our lifestyle. You know, we're going to be, you know, we have kids in hockey and private Catholic school and stuff. So their tuition will be taken care of. Their hockey is taken care of. And, but we're going to be able to live a lot more simpler and, you know, we're not going to have any sort of like financial burden or any, you know what I mean? Like just like that freedom that comes with it. I think that's life changing to me. You know, we're going to take the kids on a nice vacation and do a little, you know, more things that we, otherwise may not be able to do, or things a little quicker in our, trajectory than we thought. You know, maybe we'll get a cabin in 3 years versus, you know, 10 years. So I think I'd still call it life-changing money for sure.
Fair enough.
How's the hockey scene over there? You mentioned your head coach there. Are you head coach?
I'm head coach of our kids are in rookie mites. So these are, you know, 5 and 6 year olds. So it's a lot of just organized chaos on the ice, little pond hockey, you know, all that sort of stuff. There's, you kind of put a puck out and let them have at it. There's not too much structure, which is fun, but yeah, the hockey scene coaching in Minnesota, if you're not familiar, hockey scene in Minnesota is top notch. It's we sell out the Xcel Energy Center for our state high school tournaments every year, and it's, you know, it's awesome.
We know, and I know minor hockey's, you know, growing ever so fast in the U.S. and Minnesota is like, you know, either number one or at least top three at the minimum for USA right now. A lot of talent coming out of there, so that's why it's interesting. But you think you're going to coach throughout and keep going?
I'll coach until maybe they're like 9 or 10, and then I'll let some volunteers take over. I don't want the politics or the stress or the parent stuff. I used to coach Bantam hockey about 10 years ago, and you know, parents can kind of get in the way a little bit. And so I'll let someone else coach my kids. I'll enjoy the experience watching them, you know, from the stands. I think once they get into like more advanced levels,
Better to be a parent getting in the way than a coach. With parents trying to get in the
It's way. Tough. I mean, me and Johnny both grew up in hockey, and producer Zach as well. Every parent thinks that their kids should be getting the most ice time all the time. Makes for very, very challenging for the coaches out there. I've always
said. They're the next Connor McDavid or Bedard or Gretzky. You know, it's just like I was coaching at out of town hockey tournament, and you had a parent come up to me with a face off and breakout play on a napkin, you know, after a few drinks. Like, come on, like stay out of my way. I'm just trying to have a couple drinks here.
Yeah, I get it. This might sound like a weird question because you won the million, but when you're looking back at the competition as a whole, is there anything that you would have changed or done differently in terms of your approach or picks? Like just revisiting it now that it's in the rearview mirror, anything that if you were going to do this again going forwards, which you probably will, what would you change?
So I think I would probably reduce a little bit of like the numbers and various metrics I'd look at. I'd try to simplify it a little bit more next year. I think I got a little overcome with data points a little bit, where, you know, they conflict each other at the end of the day, and these lines are so efficient anyway that, you know, they kind of just clouds your brain and judgment. I'd also probably reduce the number of content folks I listen to, just to, you know, like I said,
stick with Forward Progress though. Stick with Forward Progress.
I'll listen to Churn Off, probably Continuous, but I'll probably try to reduce it to, you know, two or three a week versus, you know, probably like the 5 or 7 I listen to. So I'll probably just try to reduce the number of voices in my head a little bit. But at the end of the day, I really liked my process. I'd update power ratings every Monday. I really liked that part of it. I'll continue downloading the key advanced metrics with DVOA and EPA and how I, you know, did the matchup analysis using those metrics. I think those were extremely valuable. But I think it just like try to reduce the outside noise a little bit more than I thought at the end of the year, just to make things a little simpler.
How much of a role do you think luck played in your victory? Okay, go ahead.
Just yeah, no, I was gonna say a ton. Like, so many games, you know, coming down to the last minute and a half, or coming down to a 2-point conversion decision or not. I mean, there's so many points, and like even the losses. I know I had great variance this year, but like, there are a lot of the ones I did lose. There's a couple, you know, points that could have easily gone the other way too. But I think each week these games and lines are so efficient that it's going to come down to something in the last 5 minutes of the game to decide it. But, you know, definitely a lot of luck. As I think through some of the games that luck was on my, in my favor. I had the Browns the night there, or the afternoon they were playing the Jags, and Jags were about to backdoor cover, and they decided to go for two instead of kicking the extra point to make it three. And that was the difference between covering and not covering. So that's one example. Zay Flowers not taking a knee on an end around in house of it. So I had the Ravens that night. That was on my side, you know, like, so there's like little things. But then I had KC when they were favored against Philly, and, you know, Kelsey's at the 10 and fumbles. Like, that could have gone, you know, if Kelsey gets that touchdown, they probably, you know, route Philly, and that opened the door for Philly. So like, every week I think is going to come down to, you know, there's very few rocking chairs in this league. So I think, you know, there's tons of luck. I'm sure regression will hit me hard next year, but I'm certainly enjoying this year's variance.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I might be wrong on this. It might be the Survivor, not the Millions, but did you win a blue jacket?
I did win the blue jacket. Yes.
Do you plan on wearing the blue jacket at all, or is it just like, you know, put it up in the house, it's going to remain in the closet? I'm just curious, because people have very, very differing opinions on the blue jacket.
Yeah, so the jacket's beautiful. It's designed and tailored by the same guy that does Steve Wynn's jackets, which is a really cool fun fact. I'm planning to take it out kind of like the Masters green jacket. So Derek's going to have this, you know, ceremony every year. I'll fly down to Vegas and wear it. This year was really cool going down there. There were the last two or three years worth of Champions and Millions. They had their blue jackets on for their ceremony. So it was really cool. Like, Derek really wants to build it out like a little fraternity kind of a group of guys that are able to, you know, overcome a lot of, a lot of the odds and a lot of the circumstances and stress along the way. And it'll be really cool. I'm not going to wear it definitely not on an everyday basis. It'll be a special occasion, but it's actually a beautiful jacket in person.
For those who don't know, when you sign up, they ask you, so you fill out your info, and then at the bottom it says jacket size, which is a nice touch. Just like, hey, just in case, we'll take your sizing right now.
Yeah, left arm's a little longer than the right.
Yeah. So Matt, I don't know. You mentioned listening to Pizzola's other show that gives out the football picks. Obviously, that's why you won the million. But I'm not sure how much you've listened to this particular program. At the end of every episode with every guest, we ask them to give out a plus EV and a minus EV move of life. So it doesn't have to be betting related. It could be anything. Like, hey, coach your kids hockey because you get whatever. Anything you could be. Give us your plus EV move of the week.
Plus EV move of the week, reading. Reading and absorbing information. I'd say as long as you're continually learning, reflecting, trying to self-improve, I think that's major plus EV in life.
Oh, couldn't agree more. Great EV move. What about minus EV move of the week?
Minus EV is not having a purpose or a process for something you want to accomplish in life. So I think if you want to get after something, I think you have to have a plan, goal situated. How are you going to accomplish those goals? Otherwise, I think you're going to swim an uphill battle to try to get those accomplished.
I love that piece. I really like that. First time we've heard it, and it's a very great and valid one. Finally, we'll close it off with this. If you could go back 5 years and talk to a previous version of yourself, what advice would you give to your former self?
I'd say self-belief. Trust your instincts. Do what you can to get to your goals. I'd say, yeah, like I said, go with your instincts, trust your gut, do everything you can to accomplish your goals, and keep looking forward and marching forward, and don't let outsiders tell you different.
Fair enough. I'm actually going to add in one more question before we wrap up here, just because I think it's very pertinent for our audience. This has come up a lot with previous winners of contests. where they win the contest, they go down the path of selling picks afterwards, trying to capitalize on their success. I'm not judging one way or another. I've spoken on this topic about a million times before. I think to each their own, free market, capitalism, reign supreme. Do you think that's ever an avenue that you'd pursue?
I don't think so. I think it'd be a little disingenuous for me to sell picks as someone that can't bet sports legally. I think I ran hot this year. I don't have the track record quite yet. You know, if I can do this for 2 or 3 years, maybe. But right now, I'd be comfortable giving opinions, but I'm not going to sell picks. I'll be active on Twitter, maybe not during the contest season. I don't have the thought right now to go down that path of selling picks or going down that, but you know, happy to jump on different podcasts or, you know, share opinions on things like that. But I don't think touting or touting is a bad word to you. I don't mean it that way at all, but going down the path of what a sports bettor does with the frequency and things like that, I think it'd be a little disingenuous to go down that path myself.
Well, really appreciate you sharing your story, Matt. I could tell, it was like a roller coaster for you this year. I'm very happy that you won. You seem like a great guy. $1 million top prize again, 62-27-1 against the spread. Those are the years that dreams are made of right there. You can follow him on Twitter at Matty Saint, or X, whatever we want to say nowadays. Matt, all the
it's
best.
It's not coming back, buddy.
It's Twitter not ain't coming back. Appreciate you joining us. For everyone out there, if you enjoyed this interview, smash that like button down below. Make sure you're subbed here on Circles Off. We'll be back next week with another interview. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned next week for another edition of Circles Off.